John Jay Institute for Faith, Society, and Law is named for American founder John Jay. John Jay was arguably the most religious, social, and political conservative of the principal founders of the United States of America. His public life included service as member and president of the Continental Congress, diplomatic envoy, chief justice of the United States, and governor of New York. Jay's prominence as a statesman, churchman, citizen, and social reformer is a legacy to preserve and perpetuate. His dedication to the ideals of love and mercy, truth and justice guided his public labors. In honor of his life and principled leadership, the John Jay Institute is dedicated to developing leaders like him for the future. The John Jay Institute is pleased to provide you with this special audio presentation. This audio CD is specially formatted to allow you to access a printable version of this lecture from your personal computer. Now to introduce our speaker, here is the president of the John Jay Institute, Alan Crippen.
The late Richard Weaver was a professor of English at the University of Chicago. His book, Ideas Have Consequences, has become part of the canon of American conservatism since its original publication in 1948. In this book, Weaver elegantly argues for a transcendent source of truth for understanding the nature and destiny of humankind. For Weaver, the current cultural crises, moral, social, political, and economic, are at bottom about ideas. Our crises are about bad ideas that have taken root in Western civilization. Specifically, the foremost of these pernicious ideas is the abandonment, if not outright denial, of the idea of objective truth. The consequences of the abandonment of objective truth are the relativism and skepticism that so thoroughly pervade culture, society, and politics today. Another seminal thinker in these matters was a contemporary of Weaver's. Christopher Dawson, a mid-20th century British historian, was deeply concerned to understand how Western civilization had been so thoroughly transformed from an essentially Christian culture to a post-Christian one. The pressing question for Dawson was, how could a social way of life that was largely based on Christian faith and its assumptions about God and human nature, this world and the next one, have given way to the cacophony of secular and religiously pluralistic views that are held today? Dawson understood that this great cultural change ultimately had taken place on a plane of ideas. In his 1960 essay entitled The Historic Reality of Christian Culture, Dawson wrote, "I do believe that it has been on the plane of ideas that the process of the secularization of culture began, and it is only by a change of ideas that this process can be reversed. It has always been the weakness of the Anglo-Saxon tradition to underestimate the influence of ideas on life and of contemplation on action, and the result of this error has been that many in England and America never realized the existence of culture until the culture of the age had ceased to be Christian." The postmortems of Christian culture offered by conservative thinkers like Weaver, Dawson, and others serve as a clarion call for more serious understanding of how culture changes. Specifically, how do cultures change and what, if anything, can be done by people of faith to change culture for the better? Is the outlook for the renewal of Christian culture feasible, realistic, or even desirable? In the lecture that follows, Dr. James Davison Hunter argues that cultural change certainly involves ideas, but that it is only in certain times and under specific circumstances that ideas are ever influential in changing culture. Drawing upon the work of University of Pennsylvania Professor Randall Collins' landmark book, The Sociology of Philosophies, A Global Theory of Intellectual Change, Hunter argues that ideas become ways of life or cultures through specific social conditions that involve networks of intellectuals. Every civilization is theorized before it comes into being, so a network of elites is the requisite social condition for the emergence of a civilization. Hunter is constructively critical of the plethora of Christian worldview education efforts that have emerged in recent years, not because a worldview is unimportant, but rather because the task of simply developing Christian worldview thinking among the general populace is an inadequate strategy for changing culture. Hunter suggests that any effective strategy for cultural change must impact the elites. This is the lesson of both world history and, in fact, Christian history. Since cultural change is largely the work of elites operating within opportunity structures or professional networks of relationships at various geographic centers of cultural influence, people of faith ought to work more strategically in concentrating their efforts on these networks and centers. The author of 7 books, including the acclaimed Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America, Basic Books, 1991, Dr. James Davison Hunter is the LaBrosse Levinson Distinguished Professor of Religion, Culture, and Social Theory at the University of Virginia, and the Executive Director of the Institute for the Advanced Studies in Culture. In 2004, he was appointed by the White House to a 6-year term to the National Council of the National Endowment for the Humanities. In 2005, he won the Richard M. Weaver Prize for Scholarly Letters. Since 1995, Professor Hunter has served as the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, a university-based, interdisciplinary research center concerned with understanding contemporary cultural change and its implications for individuals, institutions, and society. Under his direction, the Institute sponsors university-wide colloquia, provides doctoral and postdoctoral research support, holds conferences, fields national surveys of public opinion on the changing political culture of the late 20th and early 21st century America, and publishes an award-winning journal, The Hedgehog Review, Critical Reflections on Contemporary Culture. Professor Hunter's newest book, To Change the World, 3 Essays on Irony, Tragedy, and the Possibility of Christianity in the Contemporary World, is forthcoming from Oxford University Press in 2010. The following lecture was delivered at the Trinity Forum as a strategy briefing for its governing board of directors and is reproduced for the John Jay Institute by the permission of the Trinity Forum and Professor Hunter. The Trinity Forum is a leadership academy that works to cultivate networks of leaders whose integrity and vision will help renew culture and promote human freedom and flourishing. Dr. James Davison Hunter on the topic, To Change the World.
It is an extraordinary privilege to be here tonight, and I have to say at first that anything I say is going to seem trite in the presence of this extraordinary beauty. It's also a great privilege to be with so many friends, many of whom I have not seen for a long time, others I know just by reputation and the example of lives lived well, but still feel a kinship with. Thank you very much for having me as your guest. When I was talking with Oz initially about coming out here to give a talk, the question in my mind was, and I guess maybe in Oz's mind and maybe in the minds of other board members, was what do academics have to say to leaders in the business or political world? The popular conception, of course, is that the academic world is an ivory tower of abstract and impractical speculation, far removed from the rough and tumble world of competition common in the world of business. How then could any academic relate to, say, a corporate executive? Well, I think you'd be surprised. The academic world can actually be as vicious, cutthroat, and competitive as any corporation or business. Perhaps you've heard the story of the academic and the businessman on safari together in Africa, and they're the best of friends. One day in the bush, their guide came running past them, yelling, "Quick, run, a lion is coming." The academic quickly sat down and put on his running shoes. His friend, the businessman, said, "What are you doing that for? You can't outrun a lion." To which the academic replied, "Yes, that may be true, but I don't need to. I really only need to outrun you." Well, perhaps more than relating to each other's strong competitive drives, the conversation between the world of business and the world of academia, in my opinion, can be exceptionally fruitful, particularly when our common focus is the desire to use our gifts and talents to do good in the world that we live in. The topic tonight of how we can be agents of change in the world is one of great importance and very timely. Even in our everyday experience, that experience seems to affirm the sense that the world is spinning faster and faster, and the workings of the world are less and less stable, less and less predictable. Indeed, we live at a time of great fluidity and volatility in our social and political arrangements, both here in America and the larger world. And while the capacity of evil seems magnified in our moment in history, there are also extraordinary, even unprecedented opportunities to strategically engage the world we live in for good. Let me make a very brief personal comment at this point. Some of you know me as a bit of a pessimist. With books like The Death of Character and Culture Wars, it's not difficult to come to this conclusion. But first, keep in mind that I inhabit an academic world in which the prevailing sensibility is one of smug complacency with the status quo. From the vantage point of mainstream academic discourse, there is no decline in our common morality. What we see, rather, is a liberation from past forms of oppression. There is no real weakening in the American family, just to give one example. The family, rather, is merely changing forms to adapt to new circumstances, and so on. What may seem to be pessimism from me is simply a challenge to the commonplaces that reign in the academic world. A part of what I do, then, is to contest the dominant assumptions and the pervasive complacencies of that academic guild. Needless to say, I would prefer to be called a realist. My position is that the sooner we understand the seriousness of the dilemmas that we face, the sooner we can constructively engage them. And engage them we can. We live at a time of unprecedented change and challenge, no question about it. It's important to understand them well. But precisely because of the changes taking place around us, it is also a time of extraordinary opportunity. My own life's work as a scholar and in the think tank I lead is just one modest attempt to take advantage of the possibilities of our time. In a time like ours, fluid, unstable, uncertain, everything is to play for. In my time with you, my agenda is to offer you a perspective on changing the world. This will entail a new vocabulary and thus new categories for thinking about cultural change. In the course of this, many of your instincts will be affirmed, just as many of your predispositions will also be challenged. As to the Trinity Forum itself, it clearly cannot be all things to all people, and it would be suicide for the organization if it were to try. For this reason, it will be a useful contribution if, in the end, there is a renewed affirmation of your core vision. The second part offers an alternative perspective on these things. The implications, it seems to me, will be pretty obvious by the time I finish, but in the details, there'll be much to talk about in the discussions that follow. Needless to say, I'm an academic. I have never met an academic, and I'm one of them, who has met a line that they could not blur. I have never met an academic who could not spin off for 3 hours into esoteria. I will do my best not to do these kinds of things, but try to stay to the basic issues. First of all, to understand how to change the world, that is, the culture that we live in, one must begin with an understanding of what it is to be changed. In short, everything hinges on how we understand the nature of culture itself. I want to begin by laying out the perspective that most Americans have of the culture that they live in, and here it is. The essence of culture is found in the hearts and minds of individuals, in what we call values that individuals hold. In other words, culture is manifested in the ways these values guide choices we individuals make about how to live, how we spend our time, how we work, how we play, how we have a marriage, how we raise kids, what we worship, and so on. By this view, civilizations are made up of the accumulation of values and the choices made on the basis of those values. A slightly more sophisticated version of this view is found in the perspective of those who speak of worldviews. But here again, worldviews exist primarily in the hearts and minds of individuals. These take form in the choices made by individuals. As Chuck Colson once said, history is little more than the recording of the rise and fall of the great ideas, the worldviews, that form our values and move us to act. This is a perfect illustration of this view. So, if a culture is good, it's because good values lead to good choices made by people. By contrast, if a culture is decadent and in decline, it's because of the values or worldviews held by individuals are mistaken, at the least, or perhaps immoral, and those corrupt values lead to bad choices. And so, if we want to change our culture, we need more and more individuals possessing the right values and therefore making better choices. Again, this is the common view. It's a very popular view and in some respects a very respected view. Consider what Thomas Jefferson said about this, and I quote, "Enlighten the people generally," Jefferson said in 1816, "and tyranny and oppressions of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of the day," end quote. This was the foundation for Jefferson's commitment to public education, and it's a sentiment that many of us here share. It's this view of culture that also leads some faith communities to evangelism as their primary means of changing the world. In other words, if people's hearts and minds are converted, they will have the right values and they will make the right choices, and culture will change to the better in turn. It's the emphasis on choice that also predisposes us to politics as a means of changing the world. In short, bad law is the outcome of bad choices made by individual politicians, judges, and policymakers. In this view, changing the world requires that we get into office those who hold the right values or possess the right worldview and therefore will make the right choices and forge the right laws. There are variations of this theme, but this view of culture as values that reside in the hearts and minds of individuals and the choices that individuals make on the basis of those values is pervasive. It leads to a view of cultural change that is equally pervasive, a view that the rise and fall of civilizations depends upon the kinds of values that its people possess. The problem is that this perspective is almost completely wrong. Just to get started, let me provide a few sample and simple illustrations to make my case. First, consider the fact that communities of faith have dominated American society for the length and breadth of its history. As late as 1960, only 2% of the American population claimed not to believe in God, and even today, only 12% of the population would call themselves secularists. This means that in America today, 88% of the people adhere to some faith commitments. And yet our culture, business culture, law and government, the academic world, popular entertainment culture, is intensely secular. Only occasionally do we hear references to transcendence, and even these are vague, generic, and void of any kind of particularity. If culture is the accumulation of values and the choices made by individuals on the basis of those values, then how is it that the American public culture today is so profoundly secular in its culture, in its character? A second illustration follows from this first one. In American history, one finds the greatest number of religious people and the greatest vitality of religious observance, without question, among traditional adherents. Evangelical and Orthodox Catholics are especially prominent. Even today, they outnumber their liberal counterparts in Protestantism and Catholicism, and the vitality of their piety and their institutions is extraordinary. Yet the history of the conservative faith traditions over the last 175 years has been one of declining influence. These faith traditions have moved from the center of cultural influence to the margins. In some arenas of American life today, they are not even in the game and exert no influence whatsoever. If culture is really just hearts and minds and the choices that we make, then the values of the largest group should be the values that prevail, but they're not. Consider by contrast the experience of the Jewish community in America. Except for a very brief period in the middle of the 20th century, the emigration from Europe during World War II, Jews have never comprised more than 3% of the American population. Yet the contribution of the Jewish community to literature, art, music, letters, film, architecture is both brilliant and unrivaled. And this in a context often defined by vicious and unrelenting anti-Semitism. In short, their influence in the shaping of culture has been quite disproportionate to their size. And needless to say, the debt America owes to this small community is immeasurable. A similar story of influence can be told of the homosexual community. Probably 3% of the American population, their influence has become enormous. Again, far disproportionate to their size. It's worth pointing out, too, that most of the gains in visibility, legitimacy, and legal rights by the gay rights movement were made during the 12 conservative years of the Reagan and Bush presidencies. In both of these latter instances, the question is the same. If culture were simply a matter of hearts and minds, the values that we hold and the choices that we make, then the influence of various minorities, whatever they are and whatever they may be, would be relatively insignificant. But again, with these instances, we know that this is not the case. Why? Why is that? Why is the common view of culture and of cultural change so flawed? Here I'm tempted to become very esoteric. For the error of this perspective derives from at least two sources deep in modern Western thought. Hegelian idealism, the view that ideas are the prime movers in history, and Lockean individualism, the view that the autonomous and rational individual is the key actor in social change. Well, but before you fall asleep, let me pull back. There is some truth in both of these traditions of thought, but they prejudice our larger view of culture and cultural change in ways that are fundamentally flawed. At this point, let me be blunt, maybe even overstate the case a little bit. If one is serious about changing the world, the first step is to discard this view of culture and how cultures change. For every strategy based upon it will fail. Not most strategies, all strategies. This is not to say that the renewal of the hearts and minds of individuals is unimportant. It is just to say that it is not decisively important if the goal is to change the world. I want to return to this point a little bit later to try to draw the distinctions a bit finer. But for now, let me move to the second part of my talk. And in this, again, try to lay out an alternative view. Let me begin with a phrase that you've all heard before. The phrase is, ideas have consequences. The phrase comes from a little book by this title, published in 1948 by the University of Chicago professor of English, Richard Weaver. It has become a mantra to many people who think about the culture today, and it has so because it is so obviously correct. Even a tough-minded economist like John Maynard Keynes recognized the truth of this insight. In his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, he writes, "The ideas of economic and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else." Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribblings of a few years back. I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared to the gradual encroachment of ideas. Yes, ideas have consequences. Yet the point I want to begin with in the second part of my talk is this, that not all ideas have consequences. And among those that do, some have greater consequences than others. So why is this? What explains the difference? The statement by Weaver would have been truer if it were reworded as, under specific conditions and circumstances, ideas have consequences. When these conditions are in place, ideas can inspire greatness, creativity, sacrifice, and human flourishing. But keep in mind, under the very same conditions, other ideas can lead to extraordinary folly or unspeakable destruction. The question is, what are those conditions and circumstances? The brilliant sociologist Peter L. Berger hints at the answer to this question when he writes, "Ideas don't succeed in history because of their inherent truthfulness, but rather because of their connection to very powerful institutions and interests." I'll repeat that. Ideas don't succeed in history because of their inherent truthfulness, but rather because of their connection to very powerful institutions and interests. It's a very provocative statement. suggestive of a different way of thinking about culture and cultural change. Let me take this suggestion and offer five propositions about culture and cultural change. There are more that I could offer, but these are the five crucial ones for tonight. And again, I want to say that these five propositions gain poignancy and traction in contrast to the idea of culture as simply the values and choices of individuals. Here they are. Proposition one. Culture is a resource, and as such, a form of power. Think of culture as a form of capital, much like money itself. I'm referring to knowledge, technical know-how, credentials, cultural accomplishments. While it can't be transferred from one generation to another, or from one individual to another, at least easily, cultural capital can be accumulated. A PhD has more cultural capital than a car mechanic. A member of the National Academy of Sciences has more cultural capital than a high school science teacher. The winner of a Nobel Prize in Literature has more cultural capital than a romance novelist. These are extreme contrasts, but you get the point. Like money, accumulated cultural capital translates into a kind of power and influence. But what kind of power? What kind of influence? It starts as credibility, an authority one possesses, which puts one in position to be taken seriously. It ends as the power to define reality itself. It is the power to name things as good, evil, right, wrong, appropriate, inappropriate, and so on. And so while many people endured the gulag, some of whom wrote about their experiences, why is it that Alexander Solzhenitsyn is taken so seriously? Certainly his Nobel Prize in Literature conferred credibility on him. This cultural capital, in turn, gave him the ability to speak on a wide range of other issues with great authority. Proposition two, culture is produced. We often speak of the spirit of the age or the spirit of capitalism or, say, the cultural ethos in America today or in the world today, as though it were a kind of ether. You can't see it, but you know it's there because people are inspired by it or infected by it. It's better to think of culture as a product, as a thing, something manufactured. But the real point I want to make about this proposition is that culture is produced not by lone individuals, rather by institutions and the elites who run them. And this is my real point. Most of us are inclined to what could be called the great man or great person view of history. It's St. Paul or St. Augustine, Luther and Calvin, Jonathan Edwards, William Wilberforce, Charles Darwin, Friedrich Nietzsche, Sigmund Freud, and the like, who stood as switchmen on the train tracks of history. It's their genius and the genius of other heroic individuals that guided the evolution of civilization in this way or that way, for better or for worse. Against this view, I would argue that the key actor in history is not individual genius, but rather the network and the new institutions that are created out of those networks. When we think of the German Reformation, for example, we naturally think of Martin Luther as the heroic figure. But Luther was surrounded by a network of others similarly committed, not only in his monastic order, but all over northern Germany, such as Gregory of Rimini, Joseph von Staupitz, the man Luther himself credited for the success of the Reformation, Philip Melanchthon, Theodor Beza, John Strum, Claude Baudel. Melanchthon was especially important, not only as the chief Protestant negotiator at the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, but for his leadership at the center of the key religious and intellectual networks of Europe. They, in turn, recreated the German university and invented a new institution, something called the Academy, as the heart of social and cultural innovation. And these proliferated through the 16th and 17th century in Protestant Europe. When we think of the Enlightenment, we think of Voltaire, Rousseau, Condorcet, and the like. And yet the power of the philosophes resided in the networks of bold and innovative thinkers sustained by the Salon, a new social institution that created an ongoing discussion about a new order of the ages. The Salons of Madame Geoffrin, De Staël and Récamier in Paris created such intellectual ferment that Napoleon himself exiled these women. It's no wonder that historians have called the Salon movement the midwife of the French Revolution. When we think of the movement that led to the outlawing of slavery in England, we think of William Wilberforce. Clearly a charismatic figure, still it was the Clapham Circle, a powerful network of Christian abolitionists that carried the day. There are innumerable examples. Freud, for one. We trace the triumph of psychotherapy in our own day to Freud. And yet Freud was just part of a network of innovators called the Vienna Circle. Even Nietzsche. Everyone agrees that Nietzsche is the philosopher of our day, now, even though he died over 100 years ago, lived in isolation. But he was not just a lonely explorer on the frontiers of knowledge. Nietzsche would have died in obscurity had it not been for the networks cultivated by Wagner, the King of Bavaria, and most importantly, his sister Elizabeth. She was a central part of the literary and political life of Germany, from Bismarck to Hitler. So important as the high priestess of the Nietzsche cult that her name was proposed to the Swedish Academy for the Nobel Prize in Literature on 3 occasions. Hitler himself attended her funeral and laid a laurel wreath on her coffin. I don't want to underplay the role of individual charisma and genius. But charisma and genius do not exist outside of networks of similarly oriented people. It is the networks that carry the day. Proposition 3. Cultural production is stratified in a rigid structure of center and periphery. Let me put it this way. With economic capital, quantity is paramount. More, at least it seems to me, is always better than less, more influential than less. But with cultural capital, it isn't quantity, but quality that counts most. It is the status of cultural credentials and accomplishments. In other words, with culture, there is a center and a periphery. The individuals, the networks, and the institutions most critically involved in the production of a culture or civilization operate in the center, where the prestige is the highest, not in the periphery where status is low. And so one may be able to get as good an education, and I truly believe this, one can get as good an education at Colorado State as you could at Harvard. But Harvard as an institution operates within the center. And Colorado State is on the periphery of cultural production. USA Today may sell more copies of newspapers than the New York Times, but it's the New York Times that is the newspaper of record in America. For better or for worse, because it is at the center and not the periphery. One can sell 100,000 copies of a book published by Zondervan or Baker and only 5,000 copies of a book published by Knopf. But it's the book by Knopf that will more likely be reviewed by the New York Review of Books or the New Republic or the Washington Post Book World, because Knopf is at the center and Zondervan is at the periphery. I could go on, but you get the picture. The status structure of culture and cultural production is of paramount importance to our discussion. Proposition 4. This is implied at this point in all the other propositions, but let me say it anyway. Cultures change from the top down. Rarely, if ever, from the bottom up. I'm prepared to make that an even stronger statement. It is sometimes true that political revolutions and economic revolts occur from the bottom up, that is, from the populace. But they are almost always short-lived, if that's all they are. Long-term cultural change always occurs from the top down. In other words, the work of world changing is the work of elites, gatekeepers who provide creative direction and management to the leading institutions of the society. The Renaissance, the Reformation, the Awakenings, the Enlightenment, the triumph of capitalism over mercantilism and feudalism, all of the democratic revolutions of the West, the rise and triumph of science, and in our own day, the triumph of the therapeutic, of postmodernism in law, architecture, literature, and popular culture, and now globalization itself, all began among elites and then percolated into the larger culture. Sometimes these world historical changes take many generations to work their way into the fabric of society. But given the power of technology, we seem to be witnessing a compression in the time between the generation of ideas and their dissemination within the larger society, a fact worth remembering in our later discussions. Before I move on to the fifth proposition, let me pause for a moment to illustrate what I've said thus far. I want to call to your attention an extraordinary work of scholarship, a book published by Harvard University Press, in the center, entitled The Sociology of Philosophies by Randall Collins. Now, I'm not going to lead you into the arcane details of this 1,100-page book. Indeed, if you have a problem with insomnia, here's the cure. I do want to highlight some things that are illustrative of what I've been talking about thus far. The book is very, very important. Again, it's an illustration, but perhaps the most significant illustration I can give. And then I'll move to Proposition 5. Collins tells a story of the origins of all recorded human civilizations. But he traces the story of the origins of these civilizations within networks of intellectuals engaged in highly abstract theorizing. We speak casually of worldviews and how worldviews become ways of life. Well, Collins shows the social conditions under which the full array of worldviews originated and how they formed the basis of every world civilization. These are incredibly complicated networks, and he in fact has diagrams that show the relationship of Socrates to Plato and all these others. It really is a marvel. He shows this for ancient Greece, early Christianity, and even the modern age in the West. Collins details these associations in China, India, Japan, Judaism, and Islam. And again, he creates a matrix that is incredibly complicated, lines drawn from individual to individual, and so on. But why is this interesting? Why is it important? First, because every civilization is theorized before it comes into being in an enormous output of cultural product that includes sacred texts, expository texts, and oral tradition. Okay? Cultural product. But it is the networks that are the key actors here. Collins says that it's the networks which write the plot of the story. The third thing that's interesting is that these networks operate around what he calls the peaks, what I have called the center of social life. He also makes it very clear that the size of a population within a certain region of the world or civilization is relatively unimportant. It doesn't take a large number of elites operating in strategic ways to make world historical changes in the direction of a civilization. Indeed, according to Collins, the total number of philosophers who are significant in world history, who in fact define the contours of each civilization, is approximately 135 to 500 people. The small number, if we only take the major figures, the Socrates, the Platos, the Muhammads, Jesus, and so on, the larger number, or the intermediate number, if we add secondary figures. Collins goes beyond and adds a third layer. And even if we add these minor figures in all of the networks, in all of the civilizations, the total is 2,700 people. In other words, between 150 to 3,000 people, a tiny fraction of the 23 billion people who lived between 600 BC and 1900 AD, framed the major contours of all world civilizations. Clearly, these changes, these transformations, occurred from the top down. Let me move to Proposition 5. World changing is most intense when the networks of elites and the institutions they lead overlap. Implied here is the overlapping of the different forms of capital, cultural capital, overlapping with economic capital, overlapping with political capital. And again, one can cite dozens and dozens of illustrations, a few. In the Reformation, the role of the nobility in the German provinces was crucial to the success of the Reformation. Their economic and political capital made the difference. Indeed, Luther would likely have been executed if Frederick of Wise had not given him safe refuge at Wartburg Castle after the Edict of Worms. The story of Wilberforce and of the Clapham Circle is also the story of overlapping elites and institutions. Wilberforce clearly had the moral charisma and political capital, but it was Hannah More, well known in literary circles, who had cultural capital, and Henry Thornton, a merchant banker, who had financial capital, others as well. The same with Darwin's success and the success of literary modernism in the 20th century and humanistic Marxism in the middle of the 20th century. Even Nietzsche's posthumous influence is directly tied to the political capital his work enjoyed among the Nazis and the financial capital provided by the German Count Kessler and the wealthy Swiss banker Ernest Thiel. I'll give you an even closer example, at least an example closer to home, Billy Graham. An unknown itinerant preacher whose urban crusades repeatedly fizzled out until William Randolph Hearst ordered his media network in these two words, Puff Graham, during the Los Angeles Crusade of 1949. Within 2 months of this order, Graham was preaching to crowds of 350,000, and no one who has studied Graham's biography disagrees that without the economic and cultural leverage provided by Hearst, we would have not likely have ever heard of Graham, or very few of us. In each of these cases, the impetus, energy, and direction for changing the world was found where cultural, economic, and often political resources overlapped, where networks of elites who generated these various resources came together in common purpose. In common purpose. At this point, it will not be difficult to work through the practical implications of these five propositions. Overlapping networks of leaders and overlapping resources, all operating in the center or peak institutions in common purpose. These are the practical dynamics of world changing. These are the conditions under which ideas finally have consequences. It is tempting to think, by way of conclusion, that the problems of our day trace back to the problems in our hearts and in our minds, that somehow we just lost track of what was important, and now have just lost our way. Please don't get me wrong. I believe that in our hearts and minds, we as individuals and as a society have often lost track of what is important, and that we have, in very many respects, lost our way. In this light, the renewal of our hearts and minds is not only important, it is essential. Indeed, it is a precondition for a truly just and humane society. But by itself, it will not accomplish the objectives and the ideals we all hope for. To change the world is, at some level and at some point, to take power seriously. I recognize that power is an uncomfortable subject for people of faith and all people of goodwill, who quite rightly celebrate service in the cause of the needy, the estranged, and the common good of humanity. But the power we need to take seriously is not power in a conventional sense. Politics will never be the solution to the challenges we face today. The work of the political left and the political right, even in, and especially in the Christian right, often make matters worse. And so I say again, the power we need to take seriously is not power in a conventional sense. Rather, it is the power to define reality in ways that sustain benevolence and justice. What is at stake? Well, very simply, when cultures are good, they give life and they foster human flourishing. And when they are decadent and corrupt, they constrict human flourishing and even deprive life itself. In the world we live in, the outcome is far from certain. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, everything is to play for in our moment. But this kind of power, for better or for worse, is the burden of leaders. In this respect, we do well to remember, as a corrective and as a caution, that Jesus reserved his harshest criticism for the ruling elites of his day, not least the Sadducees, Pharisees, and scribes, cultural elites whose power was not used well. And yet even Jesus created a network of disciples. Though they originated on the periphery of the social world of that age, they moved to a provincial center in Jerusalem, and then within a generation, the center of the ancient world, Rome itself. They too created new institutions that not only articulated but embodied an alternative to the reigning ways of life of that time. We too have the joy and the privilege of doing the same in our own generation, in humble and faithful obedience to the call God has placed on our lives. Let's not kid ourselves. The task is long-term and certainly arduous, and the work is finally not in our hands. But the potential consequence of our faithfulness to this task for the common good in this extraordinary time of uncertainty may be far more than we can even imagine. Thank you very much.
What does Professor Hunter's lecture imply about cultural change? It implies that the overlapping of different forms of capital, cultural capital overlapping with economic capital, overlapping with political capital, forms the necessary conditions for cultural change. The historic examples abound. In the 16th century, Martin Luther, the faculty of Wittenberg University, its students, and the aristocracy of Saxony produced the Reformation. In the 18th century, John Witherspoon and his Seminary of Sedition at Princeton on the eve of the American Revolution shaped the future of the American Republic by forming the men who shaped America and by networking them together for future public service. In the early 19th century, William Wilberforce and his circle of 10 friends on the Clapham Common just outside London abolished Britain's slave trade and changed their society for the better with several other significant social reforms. What changes a culture? Overlapping networks of leaders and overlapping resources, all operating in or near the nation's cultural centers in common purpose. This is the way, argues Professor Hunter, that cultures are changed. What can be done to contribute to the sufficient conditions or opportunity structures to facilitate a way to change the culture? What might this entail? Is there a strategy for facilitating a network of leaders with overlapping resources that will operate in cultural centers toward a common purpose? Is there a way to create or enhance such opportunity structures so as to advance Christian ideals in culture, society, and politics? The John Jay Institute is committed to such a task by preparing principal Christian leaders for public life. Our vision is to build a prestigious post-undergraduate leadership development program that competes in quality and influence with similar programs like the Rhodes, Fulbright, and Marshall scholarships, and with the Aspen Institute. The difference is that our program is manifestly Christian in purpose and substance. The Institute offers a post-undergraduate fellowship to the best and brightest Christian young people who hail from America's center universities. Upon their enrollment at the Institute, it is our task to form them spiritually, intellectually, and professionally to be agents of positive and principled change in American public life. After a semester-long academic residency, John Jay Institute fellows are then inducted into an emerging professional fraternity, the Society of St. George, of like-minded Christians who share the same vocational calling to public service. Upon entry into the fraternity, they are professionally placed in strategic externships in various governmental and non-governmental organizations to begin their careers with a network already in place. Throughout their careers, the Institute offers assistance in job and graduate school placement, further professional networking, continuing education opportunities, mentoring, career coaching, and spiritual encouragement. The vision is to see John Jay Institute alumni characterized by the Christian virtues and professionally networked as principled leaders in the public square. These men and women will champion the ideals of law and liberty in the halls of Congress, as well as in America's state houses, in the White House West Wing, and in the mansions of state governors, at the barrister's rail and on the judge's bench in courtrooms across the land, in the State Department and at the United Nations, in university lecture halls and libraries, in church pulpits and on seminary podiums, among the pundits and the political journalists who shape public opinion, and in a myriad of think tanks, schools, social service, and other philanthropic nonprofit organizations. Can strategic action be taken to change our culture for the better? The John Jay Institute believes so and is committed to such action. The Institute strongly desires to explore how, together, we might create and facilitate the opportunity structures that link leaders, scholars, and students with the various networks that can have a significantly positive role in redirecting and reorienting our culture to its Christian, intellectual, and moral foundation. Together, ours can be a different future. I'm Alan Crippen, founder and president of the John Jay Institute for Faith, Society, and Law. Thank you for listening and for your interest in the vision and work of the Institute. If you would like to learn more about the Institute, please visit our website at www.johnjayinstitute.org. www.johnjayinstitute.org. Or telephone our office at 719-471-8900.